Try that now. How's that? I inadvertently turned it off once again. Okay. I'm going to get myself into a lot of trouble tonight. Harold gave me a paper, which was a talk by the present Pope, which created a bit of a disturbance in the Islamic community, because he quoted a 14th century Byzantine emperor to the effect that one cannot use violence to convert anybody to a religion, that any engagement of a religion has to be voluntary or volitional, which led into a discussion of basically, is God rational? And I'm very grateful to Harold for giving me the paper because it answered a question that I've had since about 1970, which is, where did things get screwed up? And they got screwed up when the Greeks translated the Old Testament into Greek in Alexandria, which I don't know when exactly that happened. But that's an aside. We'll come back to that if it's relevant another time. Last week we talked about faith, and I posed a distinction between faith and belief, which many of you corroborated through your own experience. So when you thought of belief, there was a kind of closing down and a rigidification, and when you thought of faith, there was an opening and a relaxation, and there may be a challenge with it, but it was that opening quality that many of you identified. Buddhism and, let's say, the Abrahamic religions, at least Christianity and Islam anyway, they approach things somewhat differently. The central theological problem in Christianity, and I would think by extension Islam also, is the existence of pain. C.S. Lewis, who is one of the more popular Christian writers of the 20th century, wrote a little book, actually, on the problem of pain. And the problem arises because of the belief in an all-powerful, all-loving God. And if there's an all-powerful, all-loving God, then why do we suffer? That's the central theological problem. Why do we suffer? But it arises because of that belief. Buddhism, by contrast, we actually don't posit any belief as such. As Stephen Batchelor points out in Buddhism Without Beliefs, we start with the one of the things that we know about our lives. We struggle. It isn't to say that life is a struggle, i.e. that life is suffering. That's an incorrect characterization of the First Noble Truth. First Noble Truth simply says there is suffering, there is struggle in life. How many of you feel that there isn't any struggle in life? Okay, so you see, we all have that as part of our experience. And Stephen Badger points out that's the recognition. And with that recognition, we become curious. as, okay, what's going on here? So, and without positing any kind of belief about this, we say, okay, we struggle. What causes that? Why is that happening? And we don't have to reconcile it with anything. We are free to just open to that experience of struggle and follow it wherever it leads us. And that's exactly what we do in Buddhism. We open to the experience of struggling in our lives and follow it wherever it may lead. Where it happens to lead, if you go deeply enough into it, is the second noble truth. We suffer because we react to things emotionally, and that reaction is based on projections arising from a sense of self. And when we explore that sense of self or that identity that we think we have, we find that there's actually not very much there. And if we can actually experience that, then life just gets a whole bunch easier. Or as another person that I'm currently reading says, it's about learning how to live life skillfully. And the way that we actually live life skillfully means that we come to discover, as we explore that more and more deeply, that any sense of a abiding identity or abiding notion of who we are actually causes problems, because inevitably we run into a situation where that sense of ourselves just doesn't work. So we have to develop a fluid, flexible sense of who we are, and in this way we become responsive to situations. So I just wanted to throw that in as a little coda to our discussion last week. It's a very significant contrast whether you start with the fact of one's experience, which is that here we are in this life and we seem to have some problems with it and we just explore that, or whether you start with a belief about how the world is and then you've got to try to explain your experience in terms of that belief. It gets a little problematic. Now, the question the topic for this evening, probably the next two, perhaps three, I'm not sure, classes, is the spiritual friend, which you can understand as teacher. I'm not sure that spiritual friend is a good translation. As Trungpa said, he or she is a very heavy-handed friend. And I apologize because I was a little bit rushed coming over. What were the questions that I left you in terms of for reflections?
The reflection? You want to
get in? Oh, thanks very much, Joe. Okay. What I'd like to focus on just for a few minutes before I get into this chapter, thank you, is when you think of working with a teacher, what comes up for you? We have microphones? Thanks, Linnea. Okay. Can you pass it to Joe, please? And I'm not so much ideas and stories, but what's the actual experience? You know, do you freeze? Do you?
My experience has been a variety of responses. One of which is fear, and also gratitude. A sense of excitement at possibility.
What happens physically?
I'm sorry?
What happens physically?
If it's fear, I get tense. Stomach clenches.
That's why you never come to see me, right?
That's why. Yeah. My story making facility is, you know, goes into hyperdrive.
Okay.
On the positive side of gratitude and hope, there's a kind of I was trying to think of it. It was kind of like a. It sounds sort of corny, but it's like a fluttering of the heart.
Okay. Right. Okay, that's good. Anybody else? Harold.
First thing that came to my mind, or one of the things that came to my mind, is a question: why is the teacher-student relationship superior to a dialogue relationship?
Could you bring that question up either at the end of this class or the beginning of the next one, because that'll be the relevant point for it? It's a good question. I'd like to pursue it, but it takes us a bit off topic right now. Okay?
Yes.
Great. Thanks. Anybody else's experience when they think of working with a teacher? Pat?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is it's very intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a certain accountability. And I remember going to a six-day teaching with the Dalai Lama, and he spent a whole day on the teacher-student relationship. And I remember thinking, oh, Christ, how can we spend a whole day on this? And I remember at one point, you know, and it wasn't that easy to understand some of it. And I remember at one point, though, he said something about taking 3 years just to observe your teacher. And that made a big impression on me. But I had already observed for 3 years, so it didn't matter.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, where are we, Pat?
I was long gone.
But I actually had that experience, not for 3 years, but there was a woman that was a part of was a participant in a meditation group, and she never said anything. And any time I asked her a question, she never said anything. She was just demure. And a year later, she said, okay, I don't think you're prejudiced, so I think I can study with you. It's like, I didn't even know I was being examined. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Kyle. It's on. Just speak into it, and just speak right into it. Then it gets the best sound. Thank you.
Well, if you're the student, I would think that you'd almost have to have a little bit of humbling, because you can't really, if you're not very humble around your teacher, the temptation would almost be to kind of argue, maybe, or
never experienced
question. So.
What about? I'm translating that. What you're talking about is humility, is a respectful attitude. Yeah. How do you pose questions then? I mean, is that important, or?
Well, I think there's a way of posing questions respectfully,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't there? I mean, to me, a humble question would be a genuine question where you don't understand, which would be different from questioning in the sense that you're trying to maybe knock the ground out from under your teacher, in a sense.
Well, yeah, I think you're touching on a very good point, that the questions come from a desire to learn, not from a desire to make a point. Yeah, and there's a very definite difference in that. Okay, good. Anybody else? Randy, last one.
I felt like I had, I probably should have felt fear, but I didn't. But I did feel like I've connected with someone who could not only understand where I was at, but talk about it in a way that I would understand.
Mm-hmm.
I would have the right words.
How did you experience that in your body?
Quite open. And humbling.
All right. Let's turn to our text here. I'm going to go through this fairly slowly because there's actually quite a lot of technical stuff which one doesn't recognize as technical stuff in the translation. Yes.
Can I just make a quick request?
Pat, could you?
I just wanted to make a request that I noticed in the last couple of classes that I've been to that sometimes when you're reading from the text, you speed through it a little bit, because you'll read and then you'll comment, and I just request that you maybe slow down on the reading part, because okay. I don't have the book in front of me, and
you'd like to take it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think we can do that. Thank you. Okay. Now, let's start with our usual question. This is a chapter on teacher. What question is meeting a teacher an answer to? It's our version of Jeopardy in this class. Let's hear from some people who haven't spoken up yet. What question is meeting a teacher an answer to? Susan.
How will I know what to do?
How will I know what to do? Okay, that's good. Anybody else? Yes.
How can I go through this?
How can I do this?
Yep. How can I go through it?
How can you go through it? Ah. Explain the difference there, would you?
Not about doing something, but about experiencing something. It's okay. A difference.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there are two possibilities. Does anybody else have another one? Okay. Steve? Now he's got two mics.
How will I have the opportunity to go down this path and discover discovery?
Okay. Perry.
Is this possible?
Okay, I think all of these are good candidates. How will I know how to do this? How will I go through it? How can I discover this path, basically, and is this possible? And a teacher, meeting a teacher, provides some form of answer to all of those questions. And touching on your question, Harold, you can begin to see how the teacher-student relationship is a little bit different from just a dialogue. Because possibilities are being revealed. Techniques, abilities, training, etc. are being transmitted. Okay? Now, in this first sentence, this means that although you may possess the most perfect working basis, but are not urged on by spiritual teachers as a contributory cause, it is difficult to set out on the path towards enlightenment because of the power of inveterate propensities due to evil deeds committed repeatedly in former times. This isn't quite English, you understand. This is Germanically flavored English. Gunther is Austrian, or was. I don't know whether, I think he died. And he's a very good person. I had the occasion to meet him. Kencho Jiaotsen's translation is a little easier. Even though we have the excellent working basis of precious human life, if we are not encouraged by spiritual masters, then it will be difficult to follow the path of enlightenment because of the power of the non-virtuous inveterate propensities. Oh, they liked that phrase, didn't they? Of previous lives and the force of habitual tendencies. Now, people react in different ways to this emphasis on having a teacher. An old way of analyzing the American mind is that it is composed of two archetypes, the Puritan and the cowboy. The Puritan wants everything to be just right, and has this idea of great or everything very ordered, pure morals and so forth, inspiring leadership and so forth. And the cowboy wants to come from the frontier, of course, just leave me alone, let me do my own thing, I can take care of myself, don't want anybody to take care of me, thank you very much. And we see this played out in the American mind, that as soon as anybody steps, is put up in a leadership position, then a bunch of people attack him or her and tear him down and goes back. And then everybody laments about how we don't have any good leaders, so somebody else is put up in leadership position and then everybody attacks him and he's pulled down and just goes around and around. Same thing happens in Buddhism. This is about my own awakening, so what do I need you? Besides, there have been lots of people in the past who have woken up by themselves, so why do I need a teacher? Carrie?
Just from having lived in a Hindu ashram?
Yes.
I think it's the tendency of people, though, to, with what you're saying, just in keeping with that, to choose a guru and to all but deify a person.
That's the Puritan side.
Definitely. Yeah. And when they don't live up to your expectations,
then you tear them down.
Then you tear them down.
Yeah.
But I also think that people are prone to wanting to give all of their power away. And a teacher, so that they don't have to accept responsibility. And a teacher is someone from whom you can learn from their example, but they're still allowed to be imperfect.
Oh, thank you. A couple of teachers, Maureen Stewart, who is a Zen teacher and lived in Cambridge, and Ajahn Chah, both used to say the same thing. It's quite different from what Gampopa was saying. He said, a teacher needs to make their faults very evident, otherwise the student will think Buddha resides in the teacher, not in themselves. But the reason that a teacher is regarded as important is that you have this wonderful phrase, the inveterate propensities due to evil deeds committed repeatedly in former times. In other words, we have, we've made a mess out of our lives so far, which is why we're studying. You know, if our lives were fine, we wouldn't be here. And we need someone to show us our way, a way out of this mess of habitual patterns or whatever you want to call it. Now, there are some people who experience spontaneous awakening. most of those that I've met, the awakening is partial. They get one piece or another piece. It's not complete. It's not well-rounded. There are a few who have very, who are quite remarkable, but most of them, it's a partial awakening. And this is one of the things that I think is important, is that it's not an on-off switch. There are, you can be a little bit awake and then more awake, and ideally completely awake. I'm not sure that completely awake is a theoretical possibility. It's something I've discussed with a lot of people. Certainly, in traditional things, the idea that there is Buddhahood and that's it. But when you read the text, you find that, okay, there's 10 levels of bodhisattva in the Mahayana, or 4 levels of arhat in the Theravada, and there's Buddha. That's meant to be the 11th stage in the Mahayana. And then, strange enough, you find a 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, I think even one text I found a 16th stage. You're getting pretty rarefied at this point. So, but the what it points to me is that there may be a whole sequence of opening. So I'm not sure that there is an actual limit to the extent we can open or be awake. The main thing is that we have these habitual patterns, and they're sufficiently strong, they sufficiently condition our experience, that it's very difficult for us to know, to find the way out of the maze that we find ourselves in. How many of you have felt that you were doing absolutely the right thing in a situation only to discover that you were completely wrong? Yeah, I think we've all experienced that. And so one of the functions of a teacher is to be able to point us to possibilities beyond the functioning of our habitual patterns. That's one function of the teacher. Second function of the teacher is to point us to the functioning of the habitual patterns, even if we think it's actually being awake, it's not. And third function of a teacher is to provide us training in the techniques and the development of the skills that we will need in this journey that we're embarking on. So I think it's fair to say that for somewhere between 95 and 99% of the population, we need a teacher. We'll let the other 1 or 2% worry about themselves. Now, Gampopa does the usual thing here. The first thing he discusses is why is a teacher necessary? And the first thing that is usually done in traditional texts is they quote scripture, teachings of the past. So we have from one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, virtuous disciples, having respect for the guru, should always be in touch with wise gurus, because from them the virtues of a wise man spring. And from another one, thus a bodhisattva mahasattva who wishes to attain unsurpassable enlightenment must first approach, then meet, and honor spiritual friends or spiritual masters. Now, what Gunther calls necessity is really just logic. And that's how Kenchok Jeltsin translates it. I want to say a bit about this word omniscient that we find. One who wishes to achieve, on page 70 in Kenchok Jeltsin's translation, One who wishes to achieve the omniscient state should attend a spiritual master because of not knowing how to accumulate merit or how to purify obscurations. So there are two or three words that I want to talk about here, because we're going to encounter them again and again. I think it'd be good to get clear about them. First is this word omniscient. Now, the Tibetan is Tamche Chenpa, or Tamche Kempa. And it literally means all-knowing. Is it possible to know everything? Okay. The smartest people in the world, how much of the sum of human knowledge do they know? An extraordinarily small fraction at this point. I listened to a professor way, way back, and he said the last person to know everything in Western culture was a person called William Black, who died in 1842. And by that, it means this was a person who lived in England, I believe, who was conversant with a whole range of Western knowledge at that point. In Tibet, it was possible to know everything because you had teachers as late as the 19th century, Jamgon Kongtrul the Great, Khyentse Wangpo, and others and even one teacher I knew in the 20th century, Desmond Rinpoche. I mean, these are people who knew the Tibetan Buddhist scriptures, which are 108 volumes, all somewhat larger than this. They knew them virtually by heart. And if you quoted something, they would say, yeah, that'll be in that book, that chapter, or on that page. I mean, phenomenal. And they're also completely conversant in medicine, grammar, astrology, all of these things. They really knew pretty well everything that covered the range of Tibetan learning. Jamgon Kongtrul wrote an encyclopedia, which again is about four of these volumes, in which he summarizes all of Tibetan learning. And it's being translated into English, into 10 very, very large books. But it's not possible. I mean, even if you are a brilliant scientist or a brilliant expert in one field, that's all you know. You don't know the vast range of other knowledge. And by modern estimates, there is more knowledge being generated each year than existed for most of previous humanity. So what does this phrase omniscient refer to? It's when it's not possible to know everything. I mean, we get the idea that getting Buddhahood is like getting a super PhD or something like that. And one would be conversant with nuclear physics and biometrics and all kinds of, you know, sociological theory, etc. But that isn't what it means. What I'd like you to consider is, rather than all-knowing, let's change that all to complete knowing. So that in each moment of experience, knowing is complete. Everything is known in each moment. Everything in each moment of experience is known. And you say, well, what's the big deal there? Well, I want to put this in really practical terms that we may be able to relate to, because this is part of the demythologization or demythification that I'm interested in. How many of you had the experience of being, I have to use this terminology, of being totally present in a situation, so like there was an all-encompassing knowing, and you're aware of everything that was going on around you. Okay, anybody had that experience? Okay. What is your ability to respond in such at such moments? I mean, how well are you able to function when that's happening? One's able to function pretty well because one is completely aware. In fact, one can be functioning so well that what one does can look like magic to somebody else. Okay, this is what I think this term is actually referring to. It's not like one knows everything in the universe. It's that there is complete knowing of that experience. And because of that complete knowing, there is complete understanding, complete responsiveness, and so forth and so forth. So that's, I'm going to suggest you think about omniscience in that way, as something that's actually very accessible to all of us, and not as this very, very remote possibility. There's a microphone here. What's your name?
My name?
Yeah.
Valeria.
Valeria?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I guess what I wanted to say, to add to what you just said, there's an almost a sense of effortless experience. There's not, in those moments, like, different the experience of knowing details or facts. Of just being and knowing the experience, there's a sense of there's no effort.
That's quite right. But what I wanted to bring out right now is, rather than think of omniscience as some kind of like super PhD, it's an immediate knowing of what is arising right now. Then we come to this phrase, accumulate merit and purify obscurations. Well, these are technical terms, and you'll come across them again and again, and sometimes they'll be called accumulate merit or accumulate the gatherings or gather the accumulations, some things like that. And then you have this wonderful phrase, purify obscurations, which is completely idiotic English. Because we don't purify the obscurations, we purify ourselves of obscurations. We don't want to end up with pure obscurations. Unfortunately, this kind of Buddhist English has developed, so I'm going to do my best in this class to move away from it. Now, we'll run across this several times in the chapter. This notion of merit, did we discuss this before? A bit, okay. It's the word for luck. If you do good things happen to you. Right? In other words, if you do good, you have good luck. Now, this is intimately connected with the workings of karma. By the way, I was looking at in a bookstore the other night, and I came across this phrase in a book written by one of my colleagues called How to Manage Your Karma. And I thought that was very strange. Because from Buddhist point of view, karma is just the way things work. The most comparable thing would be gravity. In science, and gravity is just how things function, you know, and it's the law of attraction between bodies, and so that when I let something go, it falls, and the sun revolves around, or the earth revolves around the sun, and the moon around the earth, and so forth. It's all because of gravity. How many of you think of managing gravity? So managing our karma just struck me as another very strange phrase to be using in English. What merit or luck or and the word that I prefer to use for this is goodness. that we generate goodness in our lives. I think another author likes to use the term well-being. And I think, so rather than this abstract quality which we can accumulate, merit, if you think of this as generating goodness, generating well-being, then I think it makes it's a little easier to understand. Because when you generate goodness or generate well-being in your life, you naturally generate a sense of balance. You naturally generate the conditions where you are more responsive, more open, less reactive, more empathetic, and so forth. And you generate the an environment in which good things can happen. So that's a very important part of practice, is learning how to generate goodness or well-being in our lives. Then removing obscurations, I'm not going to say purify obscurations, removing obscurations or refining away obscurations would also be a translation. I've thought a lot about this word, and it seems that the best English word, or the word that comes closest to the meaning, as I understand it, is the word is distortion. Now, if you have a glass of water, this glass isn't a particularly good example because it has all the things. But if you have a clear glass of water, you know, just plain simple glass, and if the water is still, then you can look through the glass and you can see things very clearly. But if the water is turbid, and it's churning around the glass, then it introduces a whole bunch of distortion. It reflects the light in unpredictable ways, and you can't see clearly through it. Is everybody with me? Well, these distortions are, the way that I understand them, they're a turbidness or turbidity, whatever the right word is, in mind, which distorts our experience of things. So we don't experience things clearly. In particular, we experience things as being something other. That's the primary distortion, or the two primary obscurations or distortions are the distortions introduced by emotional reactivity. So when you're emotionally reactive, you don't see things clearly. You can experience your spouse or partner as an or even your child as an enemy when you're angry. That's a distortion. You can have everything you need, but feeling you need more. That's a distortion. So there's the distortions which are introduced by emotional reactivity, and then there are the distortions introduced by conceptual thinking. Or the whole process of conceptualization. Once we label something, we cease to know it. We may understand it in a certain way, but we cease actually to know it because the experience of knowing something just takes us into it. As soon as we say, well, it's this, and we stop that process. So conceptualizing limits our experience of the world and actually distorts it. One of the exercises I sometimes do with people on this is we pair people up and have them look at each other just for a couple of minutes, just straight on, and say, well, what did you see? And we get wonderful things back saying, I saw a very wise person, deeply compassionate, or, you know, I saw a person in great pain. I say, oh, that's very interesting. But that's a conclusion. What did you actually see? And it usually takes three or four questions of just this kind before they get down to, I saw two eyes, a nose, and a cheeks, a mouth, and so forth. So we are so busy conceptualizing experience that we actually don't see what's right in front of us. And You might look around your life and see just how often you do that, because most of the time when we're conceptualizing, what we're doing is drawing conclusions from the data, from the actual what we're actually experiencing, and we're not really experiencing what's right there. So those are the two obscurations or two distortions. And this phrase of generating goodness and is broadened to generating both goodness and awareness removing the distortions will come across again and again. So it's good, you'll not only in this text, but other texts you'll read, you'll come across it again and again. So it's good to understand what it means, which is why I'm taking a little time on it. Harold. Yeah, the mic's always beside you.
I really dislike this. Could we maybe spend a little bit of time on this, what you're just talking about? Because I think about it a lot. And if we go back to where you said the person saw, when he looked at the other person, he saw a nose and an eye and an ear. Well, what comes to my mind is, well, those are concepts. Those are concepts. So,
oh, sure. One can trace it back. I mean, basically, I don't want to spend too much time on this because this is an aside for the main thrust of our for this evening. But yes, those in turn are concepts, but they're lower level concepts. Eventually, you get down to shape and color and so forth. But again, as soon as you put a label on it, you stop knowing it. If you just keep letting go of the label, you'll find yourself drawn into a deeper and deeper experience.
Well, but it seems to me like you just get drawn into nothingness, because pretty soon it doesn't has any meaning. It has no meaning. I've struggled and struggled with this.
Yeah, I understand. But you're quite right. As you pursue this, you'll find yourself entering something where there are no labels. But it's incorrect to say that there's no meaning. Meaning's different, and this is something we'll come to much later in this text. I don't want to go into it now. But it's not meaning in terms of in concept, but you know what to do with what you're experiencing. But the knowing doesn't come from conceptual processes. It comes in a different way. Okay?
Okay.
Now, the positive illustration of this is the Buddhas of the three times. On the other side are solitary realizers. This is elements of a process of formal argument in Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. That is, you state your thesis, and then you give an example which supports it, and an example where it doesn't hold. Both are forms of supporting the thesis. So here, one who wishes to achieve the omniscient state should attend a spiritual master. The positive illustration of this is the Buddhas of the three times. The Buddhas of the three times attended spiritual masters and in the course of that generated goodness, removed the obscurations, and that's why they're Buddhas. On the other hand, the solitary realizers didn't attend spiritual masters. They thought they could do it on their own. Remember, we talked about them in an earlier chapter. They're the independent ones. And so they achieve a partial awakening. They don't really become Buddhas. And this is just elements of a form of argument. To explain, in order to achieve the complete perfect Buddhahood, all the accumulations, including merit and primordial wisdom, must be gathered. Now, again, I want you to think of translating in this as generating goodness. Now, it's a little more difficult with this term primordial wisdom. My own translation of that is pristine awareness, but it's not a big difference. How do you accumulate pristine awareness? Why are they even talking about this? Well, all of this whole vocabulary comes from a time, as is the case in medieval societies, medieval India, and Tibet was very much a medieval society. And in such societies, monasteries are the repositories of the wealth of the culture. You may recall from the Bible that the priests stored all the grain, and when there was time of famine, I was talking about the time of pharaohs in Egypt, then the priests were ordered to release grain from the stores. And this is characteristic of medieval society. They had these large monastic estates. They would accumulate surpluses, and part of the process was that when harvests failed, then the monastery would redistribute that to the population. This is where banks started. Banks all started in monasteries. And so you have this banking metaphor, accumulate stuff. You have this, and so the idea, of course, is you have this spiritual bank account in the sky. And you have these two forms of deposit, goodness and awareness. And when you get enough, and hopefully they accumulate interest, then you get enlightened. But they're banking metaphors. And the way that you generate or accumulate pristine awareness or primordial wisdom or whatever you want to call it is by dropping into presence whenever you can. And you just drop. And generating goodness or well-being in your life is a way of creating the conditions in your life so that, that it is possible to do that. You know, when you're being hunted by the law or you're scrabbling to make ends meet or you're fighting it out in a startup company or duking it out in court because you're a lawyer or, you know, run ragged because you're a doctor in residency program, you don't have much opportunity for presence or balance. You're just running. And a lot of people, that's how they lead most of their lives. One of the things that we seek to do in our lives is generate enough goodness and well-being so that we can be present and we can actually drop into presence. And that way we continually acquaint ourselves with what it means to be present. It becomes kind of a pattern or a habit in our lives. And the more that we do that, the more it creates that being present further creates conditions for us. So it becomes a virtuous cycle rather than a vicious cycle. The thing is, how do we do this? And most of us don't know how to do it. And that's where a teacher becomes important. One of the functions of the teacher is to show us how to do precisely this. And then again, you see all the obscurations or distortions, and you see they have here the afflicting emotions and the subtle obscurations to enlightenment. That's the conceptualizing process. These have to be removed. And how do we remove those distortions? Again, that's something that we learn through our association with a spiritual teacher or spiritual master. So the logic here is that there are things that we need to know how to do that we don't know. There are things that we need to know that are possible that we don't know that are possible. And it's through the association with a spiritual teacher that we come to know those things. Now, this kind of learning is fundamentally different from the kind of learning that we're used to. Because what actually happens in the teacher-student interaction is that we're shown how to find this in ourselves. We don't get it from somebody. There's nothing to get from outside. But we're shown how to do this ourselves. And this is wonderfully captured in Buddha's last words, or what are reported as his last words. He said, I have shown you the way. Work out your own freedom. And in Buddhism, the paradigm is the teacher, not the savior. It's one who shows the way, and then each of us has to implement and find do the actual walking that way ourselves. No one can do it for us. Now, Gampopa then goes on to give three different similes for a spiritual teacher, a guide, an escort, and a boatman or ferryman. And each of these three examples points to a particular problem that can arise in practice. So the first one is as a guide. When traveling to, we're on page 70, when traveling to an unknown place without a guide, there is danger of mistaking the path, of losing the path, or straying from the path. When a good guide is followed, then there will be no danger of mistaking the path, no danger of losing the path, etc. So here, the danger is one of losing the path. There's a path which we can follow, and we can lose our way or stray from our way. Now, quite a few years ago, I translated a book which is published under the title Great Path of Awakening. It's a description of a technique of meditation called taking and sending. And it's a compassion meditation. And in the commentary, it's described as the one path traveled by all Buddhas. It's extremely easy to infer from this kind of language that there's the path, and we have to get on that path. And when we do that, we run the danger of following what has been set out and really leaving our own experience behind. And doing what we are told to do, what we're instructed or suggested that we do. And as I said right at the beginning of this course, not listening to the stammering voice in ourselves, which is asking the questions. So one of the things that I want to put forward here is, when they're talking about path this way, when Gampopa's talking about path this way, don't think of it as something that is preordained or set out, even though it's often presented that way. It's a path that we have to discover through our own efforts, and it's our path. And it is, we discover this path by exploring our own experience. What happens when we do this is that we find that what we discover is actually exactly what is set out in all the texts. And that's wonderful. That tells us, oh, okay, this seems to be going in the right direction. But the process here of discovering this through our own experience and getting corroboration from the texts and from the teachings, etc., versus trying to adopt the teachings without actually exploring our own experience, that's the contrast that I'm trying to get across. Our understanding needs to come through the exploration of our own experience, not adopting what other people have written or said. There's a Thomas Merton put together a book of poems that he wrote inspired by his readings of Chuang Tzu. I should have brought it. I didn't know I was going to need it tonight. It's called The Way of Chuang Tzu, I think. One of them is called The Duke of Something or Other and the Wheelwright. And I'm not going to do Thomas Merton justice here. But the Duke is reading these texts. And the wheelwright says, "What are you reading?" He says, "Books written by wise men." And the wheelwright said, "Alive or dead?" And the Duke says, "Dead, long ago." And the wheelwright says, "Oh, you're just reading the dust they left behind." And the Duke says, "You better explain this or I'm going to chop your head off." You know, medieval China, they tend to take things very seriously. And the wheelwright explains, "I'm a wheelwright." Now, what a wheelwright does is a person who makes wheels. And in earlier times, this was a totally non-trivial task. You had to cut wood, and you made all the spokes by hand, you know, like wagon wheels. They all had to be exactly the right length. And you had to fit them into a hub, so they all ended up exactly the right length. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a perfect circle. You had to space this out. And you didn't have nice slide rules and calculators and things like that. And you probably didn't even know the exact value of pi, which makes things really difficult. Then you had to piece wood around that or bend it around. And then on top of that, you had to put a piece of iron, which had to be cut to exactly the right length, which a little bit longer, so you could shrink it down and make a really tight wheel, which would actually hold up under the stresses that wheels did. So making a wheel was a very non-trivial task, and that's why you had specialists who did nothing but make wheels. So he says, you know, if I've done this for many years, I've figured out how to do it. This is what the wheelwright is saying to the Duke, he says, and I get it right most of the time, but I can't even tell my son how I do it. So these wise men you're reading, they took everything that was worth it with them. What you're reading is just the dust they left behind. So this is a very powerful way of saying the understanding that we're seeking here is living understanding. It's not absorbing the wisdom of the ages. It is discovering in ourselves the wisdom of the ages. And then, you know, and as we discover it in ourselves, then we read about it, you go, oh, this is cool. You know, somebody else has had this experience. I'm not nuts. This is wonderful. But it's very much about discovering it ourselves, because then it becomes ours. Then it is ours. As long as it's coming from outside, it's just something somebody else said. So this is why I'm giving you some of these things to think about each week, because I really want you to discover the stuff within yourself. So going back to the path, when we pursue this, we're going to have lots of experiences. And it is very, very possible to get caught up in one another and go down a dead-end alley, or actually to go down paths which actually cause a great deal of trouble for us. And one of the functions of the spiritual teacher is to say, what you're doing there, you may want to take another look at that because, you know, just check your experience here because I can see some problems developing. And that's very, very helpful. One of the reasons why I've developed the format that I have with people, which is seeing people individually also during retreats to have a individual meeting with everybody at the retreat every day is because I've found very, very consistently that people get stuck in their meditation practice because they think they're doing something and they think, oh, this feels, and it feels right. And after, you know, a couple of days, they're sitting there like this, and they're sure they're doing it right, but, or maybe they'll be like this for 6 months because. So having a conversation, often these things can be cleared up in literally 5-minute conversation. And so that's what we do at retreats. We have these 5-minute conversations. And people find that it just resets their practice and now allows them to explore their experience more deeply. And that's one of the primary functions of a spiritual teacher, is to help the student when the teacher sees that they may be going in a direction that is counterproductive. Now, it doesn't always work like this. Sometimes you get someone and say, well, yeah, that's all very good, Ken, but I want to do it this way, so it's nothing to do but sit back and wait. And 6 months later, they come back and say, it wasn't working so well. Or actually, I had a case of several people, you know, I give them advice at one point, and I don't see them for 5 years, and said, they come to me back and said, I didn't take your advice 5 years ago, and now I'm in this complete mess. What do I do now? And usually I say, it was too late now. I don't know. 5 years ago, I could help you, but no. So that's one of the functions of spiritual teacher, is to point out when a path is maybe going in the wrong direction, or when you're going following experience the wrong way. Do you have a question, Kyle?
Sorry, can you give an example of maybe like an experience?
Oh, sure. From my own experience. In the Zen tradition, they say you sit. Posture is really important. I have certain physical problems. And so when I was much younger, I tried very, very hard to sit in full lotus, which didn't come naturally. And I found that when I did sit in full lotus, my legs would go completely numb, not in a good way. And so, being a good young student, I would push at this. And then I managed to get one of my legs to go numb for about a half a day. I was great relief when the feeling finally did come back to it. So this was, now, I was taking this instruction too literally. I was not exploring my own experience. I was taking what was coming from outside as, this is how you do it. Now, full lotus posture is an extremely powerful posture. But if you have physical or emotional problems which prevent that posture from working, then just to push like that and ignore those problems, that's not exploring your own experience. That's adopting what you've been told. And what I had to do was to explore what was my own experience. And that has led me in a very, very different path, one that I don't find in many of the texts. But it was the only, path that actually is viable for me. And but I, if I'd been in the Zen tradition, I wouldn't be a teacher today, no question of it. As I pointed out to some Zen teachers at a conference once, and they thought, really? But so we need to find the path through exploring our own experience. And if you have a good teacher, I'll give you another example. There was a woman in New York who came to one of my retreats, and she just found the approach that I was giving about how to work with emotions really helpful. And she had a Theravadan teacher in New York. And so she wrote to me and said, he's not teaching anything like what you're teaching, Ken. But how do I study with you when you're in Los Angeles and I'm in New York? And so I wrote back and I said, what are you interested in? And said, well, how to work with emotions. And so I said to her, what I suggest you do is you take what you got out of the retreat, in particular your experience with working with emotions, and you go to your teacher in New York and you talk about that experience and ask him what he can give you from his own training in that way. And so she did, and she wrote back saying, thank you for that suggestion. We had the most wonderful conversation, et cetera, et cetera. But what she was doing up to that point was just taking what he said and just doing it rather than exploring her own experience. But when she explored her own experience and took that to the teacher, then the teacher could really give her things to work with. So I was very, very happy with that result. I thought that was great. And so we're now getting in, was something we'll get to towards the end of this chapter, is how do you relate to a spiritual teacher? You bring them your experience. So you're actually working together to find the right path for you. And that's determined through your experience. You follow? Okay. Now, the second simile is an escort. Think of this as a bodyguard. You're going into a dangerous place. If you're going into a jungle, you went with an armed escort. If you're going into territory where there are robbers and thieves and muggers, you have someone who not only knows the territory, but can protect you. So that's the point of the second simile. The first one is about losing the way. The second one is about how to meet dangers in the spiritual path. And people say, dangers? What are the dangers in the spiritual path? Well, the traditional warnings, which are not always given, but I think are important, so I will give them. Death, paralysis, and insanity. Okay. Let me go through those one by one. We're very, very complex. We have all kinds of things going on in us. As we were growing up, we learned various ways of negotiating life, certain survival strategies. Most of the problems that we now experience in our lives, because those survival strategies are still running, even though they aren't needed anymore, and they get in the way. So that when somebody threatens us, we lose our temper and walk out. This isn't a very good thing to do in a business meeting, because it prevents us from actually negotiating a good business deal, but we have that tendency in us. I imagine all of you can think of certain propensities in you which you know perfectly well don't work, but you do them anyway. Am I right? Okay. Now, depending on the strength to which those have been conditioned in us, when we try to change and move into something else, those things will usually kick up a fuss. And if we don't know how to handle them skillfully, they may actually lead us into forms of behavior which will result in our death. That can be addiction, obsession, or so forth. And these patterns, these conditioned patterns, they have no awareness in them. They're just automatic ways of functioning. But from their point of view, they would rather kill their host, which is us, than change. So we need to have a certain skill in being able to meet those kinds of dangers. Paralysis. At a certain point in spiritual practice, we will find ourselves utilizing and working with energies in the body. And it can come about through working with emotions, or come about through working with certain ways of working with the body, so that we are actually enhancing the level of energy in the body so that we can be more present and have more energy in our attention. But what we're doing then is causing the energy in our body to flow differently from the way that it has before. Again, a lot of that is stuff that got screwed up and are bringing up. But again, as we make those changes, if we don't do them the right way, then energy can go into the wrong directions and lead and really shut down the body in ways that will be like paralysis. People who've done pranayama and yoga or even certain yoga postures know the risks involved with this. It's not talked about a lot in terms of just meditation, but it can and has happened in the past. And the same is true of insanity. Now, if you want the really bad news, is that once you've been on this path for about 3 or 4 years, it's very difficult to stop without going insane. And if anybody wants to leave right now, I will quite understand. And why do I say this? After you've practiced for about 3 or 4 years, and you develop a certain momentum, you begin to relate to things in a certain way. Unless you keep riding that momentum so that you're moving more and more awake, if you just say, okay, I'm tired of this, I don't want to do it anymore, that momentum doesn't dissipate, but the energy will now flow into habituated patterns, and they will tend to get more and more stronger and stronger because you're not making any effort anymore. You're not directing the energy of those the energy in your system. So it's naturally going to go into habitual patterns, and so you become increasingly weird in certain ways, and that can manifest as obsessions on sex or food or money or power or any of the usual culprits. And so once you've formed a connection with this path and are taking it seriously, it really is better to continue. The Tibetans have a wonderful phrase saying, perhaps better not to start, but once started, better to finish. So now... you won't get a lot of people talking about this because everybody thinks this is wonderful and just go on and wonderful things will happen. And that's very true. But there are real dangers here that if you don't take them seriously, you don't consider them, then you can succumb to them. And I think it's better to know about them so that one can factor them into one's practice. And one's thinking, rather than just be rather surprised when you turn a certain corner in your practice and you find there's a monster. And you turn out, like, nobody told me there was going to be a monster there. I just did a program recently, and a person I'm working with said to me afterwards, I need to come to see you, Ken. One of the monsters just crawled out from under the bed, and I'm not quite sure what to do with it. So... but she's aware of it. Because we do have these monsters in us, and they'll eat us if we don't pay attention. So, then the third one, this is the simile of the ferryman. And I thought about this for a while, because when we read it, we get this. When crossing a big river aboard a boat without a boatman, you will not cross to the other side because the boat will either sink under the water or be taken by the river current. With a boatman, you will cross to the other shore by his efforts. Likewise, when crossing the ocean of samsara without a spiritual master to act as a boatman, then even if you enter the boat of the holy Dharma, you will be carried by the current of samsara, or will drown in samsara. Now, when you read it, it sounds like you can't do this by yourself. That's what they're saying. That didn't sound right to me, so I thought about this. And we have to take a look at what's the boatman actually doing that we can't? Steering. Pardon? Steering. Yeah, but what does the boatman have that we don't? The rudder. Yeah, but if we're in the boat and there's no boatman there, okay, with the microphones here, please. Okay, so we've got the rudder, knowledge, experience. Kara?
Like,
has a compass, knows the stars, like can navigate.
That's just a river. I don't think we have to get lost on the river. You know? It's not like the seas.
Perhaps we're getting lost in the metaphor.
Okay. Steve, Perry, there's a microphone in front of you.
Well, he knows about currents. He knows about the river.
Yeah, see, but this is all in the previous metaphor. These are all the dangers. There's something different about this one. Nava. Leslie, could you pass it over, please?
It's his profession. He does it every day. He does the same thing every day, again and again.
Yeah, if he does the same thing every day, what's he going to have that we don't? Yeah, they know the way to the other side. Come on, there's another quality. Okay. Strength. Okay. Yeah, he does this every day, right? Look at the muscles this guy's going to have. Okay, yeah, that's right. This is before motors. He's going to have strength, okay? What is strength in practice? Strength is energy. Pardon?
Tapas.
Okay, I don't know that. Is that a Hindu word or?
Yeah, it's a Hindu word for spiritual fire.
Okay. Now, we need to develop that strength. But initially, particularly in many of these traditions, one relied on the strength, that is the energy of the teacher, until one had formed a sufficient relationship that one was developing one's own strength. So that, I think, is the quality that this particular one, because we had not losing the way in the first simile of the guide, and then the escort is protecting us from the dangers, and this one is about having the strength to be able to negotiate, because the currents are very strong. The currents of our own conditioning are very strong, and sometimes we literally draw on the strength of the teacher until we develop the ability to be able to meet that ourselves. And we need to be able to develop that ability. But that is my idea about what's being focused on in this particular one. Okay. And it's 9:30 already. Okay. For next week, we're going to go into, we'll probably will spend three. By the way, is going through it at this pace okay with you? This is not too slow? Okay. Because this to me is very important, and I think you can tell by the way I'm approaching it, there's all kinds of areas that could be easily misunderstood. So I think it's worth going through quite thoroughly. Realistically, I think that we will get through the classification and the characteristics of each classification. So I'd like you to read those over for next week. And this classification is again, something that sounds, potentially very remote. We have four kinds of spiritual masters: the ordinary human being, the bodhisattva, the nimanakaya spiritual master, and so obviously we're going to get into discussion of that technical term, and then the sambhogakaya, which is even a thornier technical term. Gunter will provide footnotes on those, which may be helpful. Those of you who have a copy of Great Path of Awakening, I have quite extensive footnote on those, on the three kayas. But what I want you to think about is, what is the significance of this classification in terms of what we were discussing earlier here, that is, this is an exploration of one's own experience. The idea one gets here is that in the beginning, you know, you're just an ordinary human being, so when you can meet an ordinary human being, but when you get to a certain point, you get to meet a real-life bodhisattva. And when you get to another point, you get to meet a Buddha in physical form. And when you get really, really good, then you get to meet a Buddha in spiritual form, which is a rough translation of. So it gets better and better, right? To me, it's an extended metaphor, and I want you to think about what does this actually mean in terms of our own experience here and now, in terms of the unfolding or the maturation of our own spiritual practice. I'm just going to give you that as a question to think about. It's not a particularly easy question. So when you read the descriptions of each of these, be thinking of translating, how do I translate this into my own experience? What does this mean in terms of shifts or things that I've noticed in myself? And that's what I want to explore in some detail next week. Okay, so thank you for your attention. One announcement, or two announcements actually.